19,000 Floridians have died from COVID-19. Has the Florida Department of Health done enough to keep us safe? Hello and welcome to this Pledge edition of Sundial. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Reporters from the Sun Sentinel poured through thousands of documents from the Florida DOH and spoke with public health experts about the state's response.
We began to document the timeline of, you know, what they were holding back during each month of the pandemic so far. When you pull together like that, it was pretty overwhelming.
Plus, Diana Abu-Jaber has always loved cooking. The pandemic has changed how she shares her passion with loved ones, but it certainly hasn't stopped it.
We had a socially distanced s'mores party.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thank you for your support during this winter membership campaign. Refusing to reveal details about the spread of COVID-19. Attempting to stop public statements about the pandemic until after the November election. A new investigation from the Sun Sentinel found a pattern of secrecy and spin from Governor Ron DeSantis and his administration. Their actions may have misguided the public at a costly price, disincentivizing people to take the proper precautions and furthering the spread of the virus. The findings are based on thousands of pages of documents and interviews with scientists, politicians, employees from the state's health department, and doctors. Sun Sentinel reporters Mario Ariza and Cindy Goodman worked on this investigation. I spoke with them this morning. Cindy, reporters from the Sun Sentinel have been monitoring the state's response to COVID-19 since February. Why did you all want to take a comprehensive look at their approach now?
Well, we noticed a pattern from February when I was trying to find out about the first suspected cases in the state through today. The DeSantis administration kept continually holding back information, and reporters and legal advocates had to ask over and over again, sometimes threaten lawsuits to get the information that the public should have. So we began to document the timeline of, you know, what they were holding back during each month of the pandemic so far. And when you put it all together like that, it was pretty overwhelming to look at crucial information that we should have been getting all along, that they were giving us a hard time about getting out to the public. Some of the time they finally did release it, but it was only after a lot of pressure.
Your investigation found the state's mixed messaging and their refusal to work directly with experts and political motivations all may have worsened the extent of the pandemic here. Cindy, take us back to March. What was the Florida Department of Health telling the public about the spread of COVID-19 in the Sunshine State?
Well, first, they didn't want to even acknowledge that they were monitoring cases here. That happened in February. I was asking for them, you know, who's suspected of having the virus, and they didn't want to tell us. And then they announced their first cases and their first deaths almost simultaneously. And then came the issue of community spread. DeSantis was saying there is no community spread. Fauci was on TV naming Florida as one of the areas of the country that did have community spread. And then a few days after DeSantis said there was no community spread, he finally admitted that there were 77 cases in the state and we did have community spread. So almost from the very beginning, he set a pattern of not being transparent with the people of Florida.
And Mario, we should note that this was a matter of weeks after the Super Bowl was held in Miami, an event with tens of thousands of fans traveling from around the globe. When did the Florida DOH finally begin sounding the alarm?
The emails that we reviewed, and to be clear, we reviewed 4,000 pages of documents for this investigation, show that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention first warned the Florida Department of Health of a possible introduction of the virus on February 5th. The day before, Cindy reached out to ask them what's going on. And they got back to us with a very legalistic answer that said essentially, hey, we can't reveal any of that information, but there's nobody who's tested positive in the state. So when DeSantis later, I believe in early April, at a press conference announced as early as February in the state during the Super Bowl, you know, he was absolutely correct, but the fact is that the Department of Health was aware, and that there has an effort that was not disclosed to Floridians actively by the DeSantis administration during late January and most of February to track and try and contain the spread of the virus in the state of Florida. And that effort ultimately failed.
Well, it was a contentious process early on in the pandemic for family members to get access to any COVID-19 data. What role did journalists play in forcing that transparency?
The news organizations around the state of Florida actually hired attorneys, and they initially threatened to sue. They sent a legal notification asking the state, journalists really wanted to know on behalf of families, what nursing homes had COVID, who was being tested for COVID, how many people in which nursing homes had tested positive, who was dying from COVID in the nursing homes and the assisted living facilities. So we were trying to get access to that information. Families wanted it, the public wanted it, and we weren't being given it.
When the state has hundreds of epidemiologists working at institutions across the state, the University of Florida has a program designed specifically for that level of research. Cindy, to what extent have these experts been consulted by the state throughout the pandemic?
Well, I'll speak on that, and then I'll let Mario speak on that a little bit, because both of us talked to these scientists and these experts within Florida, and they were just so frustrated. It was just very, it was really eye-opening. They really wanted to they wanted to conduct research. They wanted to provide expertise. They had one meeting with Surgeon General Scott Rivkes, and after that one meeting, they were dismissed. They thought they were participating in what was going to be an ongoing task force to advise the state on, ways to, I guess, to contend with us and control the virus. But after the first meeting, they were dismissed and told that they weren't going to be meeting again. Along the way, they've tried to get data to conduct research. They were given, they have had a difficult time getting data out of the Department of Health that they feel would be helpful to conduct research on how to control the spread. And they're just all very frustrated.
We also reviewed documentation that showed that even in cases when these experts were brought into the Department of Health to help with fighting the virus, they weren't necessarily given the tools they needed to really contribute once they were inside, because of a broader culture of what I think we could fairly call a secrecy and perhaps fear within the department. There were data sets that were requested and weren't provided.
How has the DeSantis administration sought out advice from medical professionals whose expertise has been questioned?
Yeah, that's been one of the more interesting things to see. We call these folks the dissenters, right? This is Dr. Scott Atlas and the like. And the DeSantis administration in July and August really went out of its way to reach out to individuals who presented a non majoritarian approach to fighting the virus, right? Most of epidemiologists say, hey, you got to isolate, you got to slow the spread, you have to shut down certain parts of the economy, or at least limit the movement within restaurants and weddings and, stuff like that. But that's not what the experts that the DeSantis administration brought in were saying, right? Folks like Dr. Scott Atlas, who was the coronavirus advisor to President Trump and who has since resigned, were offering a strategy called quote-unquote focus protection, otherwise known as herd immunity. And the idea is that you can sort of let the virus rip through the majority of the population, but sort of try and build a wall around the very vulnerable individuals where it has a high death rate, seniors, folks with pre-existing conditions. That's been decidedly shown not to work, right? It's a virus with a very high reproductive rate. You can't keep it from spreading into the nursing homes. You can't keep it from reaching to the folks who are immunocompromised. And the fruits of that strategy are evident everywhere else across the nation. Dr. Atlas has resigned. And here in Florida, we're still kind of following through with it.
Wow. Well, Cindy, how could that mixed messaging from DeSantis, particularly on the efficacy of mask wearing and social distancing, how could that have impacted the spread of the virus here?
DeSantis has never really, initially he encouraged mask wearing, but since then he's made it very clear that he believes mask wearing should be voluntary. And you haven't seen a lot of messaging. We wrote about a phenomenon called blue sky messaging. That's the wording they use within the Department of Health, leading up to the end of September to, today. There has not been messaging put out about wearing masks or social distancing from the Department of Health since the end of September. As the numbers are rising, the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations, even the number of deaths are rising in the state of Florida, the Department of Health is putting out messaging such as, you know, be careful of lead poisoning, or get your flu shot, or, you know, watch out for Diabetes Awareness Month, anything but the coronavirus.
That was Cindy Goodman and Mario Ariza, reporters for the Sun Sentinel, talking about their most recent investigation. They looked into how Governor Ron DeSantis and his administration have managed the pandemic. Still to come, we're going to continue our conversation with Cindy and Mario. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. And please continue to show your support for WLRN during our winter membership campaign. Let's return to our conversation about the Sun Sentinel investigation that found Governor Ron DeSantis and his administration withheld information about COVID-19. Documents show the governor's office suppressed unfavorable facts and dismissed guidance from many public health professionals. Sun Sentinel reporters Mario Ariza and Cindy Goodman worked the investigation, and I spoke with them this morning. It sounds like the state's messaging around COVID-19 really changed as we approached the November election.
Well, I have to say, in all fairness to DeSantis, he was pretty consistent that we're not going to, from even before the end of September, he was very consistent that he's not going to lock us down again. He's not going to, he doesn't want to require masks, that it should be voluntary. He's been pretty consistent that he believes that only that young people are not at risk. Open schools, open colleges, allow sports games. That's been his pretty consistent messaging, but we noticed that right in the lead up to the election, the coronavirus pandemic was an issue for Donald Trump, who happens to be his mentor, and we noticed that he was following along with playing down the pandemic, and wherever it came from, there was an order out of Tallahassee that says, don't bring awareness to the pandemic for in the lead up to the election. We also didn't see DeSantis. DeSantis went for a while without holding any press conferences. Even as the numbers were rising in the state of Florida, he wasn't holding press conferences or addressing it until he had a vaccine to talk about.
And Mario, I'll direct this one over to you, but you were not able to secure an interview with the governor for this investigation, but you did speak with his spokesperson, Fred Piccolo. He's been active on social media, and he replaced the former spokesperson for the governor midway through this pandemic. And I'm just curious, because he's been active on social media and at times been spreading misinformation about the virus, what were some of the troubling tweets that you found from Fred Piccolo?
Yeah, so to reiterate, we did reach out to the governor pretty substantially, and we're like, hey, we'd love to talk to you. We'd love to sit down with you. These are the questions we've got. Governor chose not to answer. Fred Piccolo did respond to the questions that we put specifically to him. And he offered a lot of context for certain very problematic communications that he had on his personal Twitter feed. Now, he doesn't have a large Twitter following. He's got about 3,000 followers, but he is the governor's press spokesperson, right? And so when he gets on Twitter and says things like, COVID is less deadly than the flu for people under 60 or for people under 20 or in general, which he later in his emails were like, oh, I meant kids, right? That's still not necessarily true, and that's still not necessarily factual. COVID is twice as deadly as the flu for people above 20 years old. It's five times as deadly for people between 20 and 60. It's many, many times more deadly than the flu generally. But he also has done a lot of work tweeting about 16, 17 times about masks and mask mandates not being effective. That's not factually accurate, right? And it's sort of dangerous, in my opinion, to spread that kind of information. Because masks do work to stop the spread of the virus, and there's a lot of good data out there to show that mask mandates actually also help areas with high virus numbers control the spread of the pandemic.
And how did Piccolo justify the communication strategy from the governor's office early on in the pandemic and in the run-up to the election?
He said one answer that I think was really sort of indicative of perhaps how the governor views this. He said, according to a Pew Research poll, messaging about the coronavirus pandemic has reached saturation. And then he very kindly included the link to the poll, which had nothing to do with messaging or saturation. It was about like 80% of people using masks. So, you know, the warrant for that argument is gone. But this idea that messaging about COVID-19 has reached saturation, I'd like to address it, because everything that we've seen, all the experts that we've talked about, has said that the best way to achieve behavior change in a population and get control of the virus is to have everybody sort of marching on the same drumbeat, which is wear your mask, socially distance, take personal responsibility, do not spread the infection to others, right? And so this idea that the state of Florida doesn't necessarily have to do that anymore because it's been achieved, I think, you know, most of the evidence that we see belies that.
Well, and Cindy, what have we heard from the governor since his ally in Washington, President Trump, lost the election? Has his tone changed?
He was very quiet in the aftermath of the election. Just recently, he put out a YouTube video and then held a press conference to talk about vaccines. That's really all he wants to talk about right now, is that a vaccine is on its way. So I guess you can, you know, take that for whatever it's worth.
Do we have any reason to believe that the state strategy will change under a Biden administration?
I don't think so. DeSantis is really his own person, even though he has his own base in Florida. That's the same base pretty much as Trump. So I don't think anything's going to change. We'll see. It would be nice if we could get much more transparency. People would like to know what's going on, especially as the vaccine rolls out. I think it's going to be really important for us to know who's getting the vaccine, what the decisions are behind who gets the vaccine. You know, the positivity rate. He hasn't been really upfront in the past. They're using a positivity rate that's not necessarily the one that it's more advantageous to him to use to go with the calculation that he's going with. So I don't know. I'm hopeful. I would like to hope, and I would like to think that the public gets all the information it needs in the next few months.
Mario, what have epidemiologists told you that the state can do now to directly reduce the spread of the virus to keep Floridians healthy?
Well, the first is that messaging is very powerful, which is why our story focused on this, right? The state can create consensus around being responsible, taking individual responsibility to not spread the virus. Beyond that, you know, I've spoken with epidemiologists who have a lot of questions about the order that DeSantis gave, sort of hamstringing local municipalities from enforcing mask mandates or enforcing density requirements within restaurants and indoor dining and closing bars. And I understand that weighing the economic needs of Floridians versus the health needs of Floridians, that's a very difficult decision. But there are focused interventions that epidemiologists and virologists have discussed, right? You can find an area where there's a lot of spread, you can find super spreader events, and you can stop that spread, right? You don't have to necessarily declare defeat and say that we're not going to do anything to stop the virus. So focused interventions and focused social distancing policies do a lot of work without having broader ripple effects on the economy.
What concerns do public health experts have following Thanksgiving celebrations and as we look forward into going into Christmas and New Year's holidays?
Well, what we've seen going into Thanksgiving has been a little bit scary. We did an article right before the Thanksgiving weekend where we showed that the bars in downtown Fort Lauderdale were absolutely packed, wall-to-wall people. I went out to the bars myself and I just saw there were just tons of people there with no masks on. So there's every right to have some concern about what's to come. Right now, the hospitalizations numbers are up, but they're not worrisome yet. So hopefully they'll stay that way. There's some new interventions rolling out today. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to see this new intervention that hopefully is aimed at helping people who are positive and at risk before they get sick. So there's some hope there. The vaccine should be here in the next couple of weeks. The healthcare workers on the front lines will be the beginning of getting those, and maybe the people in the nursing homes. There is some hope on the horizon. I think everybody's watching the numbers really carefully in Florida right now. They see the bars packed. They see, you know, they see people without masks. They see local leaders not being able to enforce mask mandates. So everybody's watching and hoping for the best. And hospitalizations will really be the numbers to watch. Hospitalizations and deaths, not necessarily cases. That's an issue too. But we're going to be keeping a close eye on the hospitalizations and the death numbers.
Part of why Governor DeSantis's stance has been so has resonated so much with a lot of Floridians who don't like to wear masks, who do want to go to bars and take off their masks. It's that idea of personal liberty, that personal freedom is being infringed upon. Are you seeing that resonate with people more, or is it more that people are epidemiologists believing that people are just really tired of this? Is it a little bit of both?
Probably a little bit of both. But we did hear from a lot of people in response to our article that just don't want to be told what to do by the government. And that's just their stance. And they don't care if he's being secretive. They don't care if they don't have the information. They want everything open and they want to go about their life as normal. And it's really unfortunate when you talk to the healthcare workers and how frustrated they are. I was at the Memorial Hospital on Friday and talking to some of the healthcare workers there and just how frustrated all of them are. You know, they leave a shift and they're treating COVID patients all day long. And then they drive by and they see, you know, people walking around without masks, clustering in groups without social distancing. And it's very frustrating for them. So I think you're seeing a little bit of mix. There is COVID fatigue going on. Nobody wants to be cooped up in their house anymore. But I think those days are over. I think most people are not cooped up. They're going about their life. They're just being careful. So I guess we really are going to have to see how this all plays out. The next couple months are going to be really critical in Florida.
That was Sun Sentinel reporter Cindy Goodman and Mario Ariza talking about their most recent investigation that looks into how Governor Ron DeSantis and his administration have managed the coronavirus pandemic. You can read their reporting on our social media over at WLRN Sundial or on our website at WLRN.org. And we heard from you on our social media about the governor's response to the pandemic. William Quigley on Facebook says the governor has, quote, refused to lead, refused to step up and make the hard decision, and it's led to people dying. We also heard from Sean Patrick Perez, who says the governor is handling it better than most governors. Please share with us your thoughts about the governor's response, and you can comment on our posts on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. You can help us continue to bring you the news and analysis that keeps you informed, but also the feel-good conversations that can brighten your day. Still to come, we'll hear from a local baker who tells us about her family Christmas cookie recipe that's the perfect blend of sweet and spice. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thank you for your support during our winter membership campaign. One of my favorite things to do every December is bake my Nana's Christmas brownies. Instead of going to a cookie swap party this year, like everyone, I'll have to get creative in my drop-off strategy. Diana Abu-Jabbar lives in Fort Lauderdale, and among the books she's written includes the memoir Life Without a Recipe. That certainly feels like it describes this year. Well, this past weekend, Abu-Jabbar was in her kitchen baking her annual holiday cookies.
Now, going to mix up the dough, put the paddle attachment on, and crank it into place, and let it paddle.
She reminds us what Christmas at home can smell like and how to keep that feeling of togetherness this time of year in a safe way during the pandemic. In your books, you merge memories of members of your family and baking, your grandmother, your father, just to name a few. In your memoir called Life Without a Recipe, you write about love, death, and cake. How closely is baking tied to people in your mind?
It's very intertwined for me. I think because I grew up in such a food-obsessed family. My father always wanted to be a cook. He loved cooking, and it was his secret pleasure. You know, he worked other jobs that I guess he considered more respectable, and then on the weekends he would make these full-blown meals. So I grew up with this idea that cooking was kind of this wonderful, almost guilty secret. And sort of like a superpower too, that if you knew how to cook, you could bring people closer, invite people over, and just kind of create a community around your life. And so it became very, very important to me.
You grew up with tins and tins of your grandmother's Christmas cookies. Describe what those taste like.
Oh, those were great. Yes, this is cookie season now for my grandma. She would have started pretty much Thanksgiving Day, and she would cook nonstop until Christmas. And that's basically her main, that was her main pursuit between the holidays, was tray after tray of Christmas cookies and holiday cookies. And it's funny, I was just making probably one of her main signature cookies. They were called Wurst cakes, and I was smelling them last night, and the smell was just so redolent of her kitchen. The cookie uses a lot of allspice and clove and cinnamon. So they have a really rich, warm, almost earthy scent that brings you very close. And it was wonderful, because to me, it was like being back in her kitchen again.
Oh, it smells amazing, I can imagine. You spoke with NPR about the dynamic between your father and your grandmother and how that manifested itself over baking. Your father's from Jordan and your grandmother was from Germany. Tell us about their relationship and how this Wurst cake tied them together.
It was always touch and go with those two. They worked out a truce, but it was really tricky. My dad was, you know, an immigrant from Jordan. He was a Muslim, and my grandma was a German Catholic. And so she saw him as a real kind of dangerous, exotic intruder in her life. And he took her only daughter away and married her, of all the nerve. And so the two of them were always kind of at odds, and it reflected in their cooking styles. Dad was, you know, a very dedicated cook, and Graham was a baker. So their styles really reflected those kinds of sensibilities. Graham was scientific, precise. She believed in measurements, and Dad was improv and kind of jaunty and jazzy, and so those different sensibilities came out all the time. And I think they used their food as a way to try to lure the children. You know, my dad was always kind of luring his daughters into the kitchen, and my grandma would use her wonderful cookies and cakes and pies to lure the kids back out again.
And you mentioned you spent this past weekend baking your annual batch of holiday cookies, including that beautiful cinnamon clove Wurst cake. What else? What else have you been cooking up?
Let's see. This weekend, it's been, we started with my grandma's bourbon balls, but they are actually Kahlua balls because I didn't have bourbon. And they're wonderful, kind of chocolatey, and the Kahlua works great, but you can use any liqueur with them. And then peanut butter blossoms, which I bet a whole bunch of people know, because I think it came off of a Land O'Lakes box. I'm not sure. I think it came from that butter. But that is a family standard, and I make it with peanut butter cookie base and then chopped up chocolate bar that I stir into it. And then tonight I'm going to make chocolate dipped chocolate cookies with peppermint crumbles on top. So it's a real Christmassy, you know, chocolate minty kind of cookie.
How do you cultivate that connection that comes from sharing a meal with loved ones or sharing this traditional Christmas recipe with your family from a distance?
It's a special challenge for sure. One thing I've done with family and friends is Zoom meals. I've even done some Zoom cooking. Over the summer, my daughter and I did a series of Zoom cooking camp classes, and it was wonderful. And we got to know the other people. They were total strangers to us when the class started, and now I consider them friends. We're really lucky that we have some of this technology. I mean, I'm not at all a big techno freak. I'm actually kind of technophobic, but there are ways of making that contact with each other, even if it's electronically.
We're collecting stories about the moments from 2020 that brought us joy in the middle of so much tragedy and uncertainty. What's your moment of joy?
Ooh, there have been a lot of moments of joy for me. I feel really, really fortunate that we have good friends who are near, who live close to us, even right on our street. We had a socially distanced s'mores party, I guess it was about a month ago, where we were all really nervous about it, but the uptick in infections hadn't started quite yet, and we decided we were going to all sit outside, and we spread our chairs out across their yard. So there was a, you know, a solid 6 feet between all of us. And it was, three couples. And we sat outside around a big fire pit. And they put out a s'mores kit. So these long skewers and marshmallows, graham crackers, big chunks of chocolate bars. And basically we, you know, these grown-ups, we were all grown-ups, we all got together and made our s'mores at a distance from each other, and we were cracking up, and it was just the simplest, goofiest, best thing.
That was author and baker Diana Abu-Jabbar. You can read more about her memoir and holiday cooking by going to our Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. And please share your moment of joy from this year. Email us at talktous@wlrnnews.org or find us on social media. And that's Sundial for Monday, December 7th. Coming up on the show, the DACA program, which shields hundreds of thousands of children of undocumented immigrants from deportation, will stay intact. We'll learn how DACA recipients in South Florida are responding to the recent court ruling tomorrow. Plus, autonomous vehicles in Miami are bringing fresh produce to kids choosing to learn from home. The program is helping bridge the gap of virtual learning through school gardens. Finally, live from the 305, Season 3 kicks off with Black Violin. The trained violin players from Fort Lauderdale mix hip-hop with classical music, defying stereotypes and spreading a message of hope. They're out with a new holiday album, Give Thanks. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz. Thank you so much for listening. And please, if this program is an important part of your daily listening, consider contributing to WLRN. We can only make our show with help from people like you.